This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Earlier this month, DC Comics announced that Mad Magazine will mostly stop doing what it's done for some 6 decades, which is to pointedly mock American politics and culture. Barring the occasional end-of-year special, future copies of Mad will consist solely of old material. The publication, which first appeared in 1957, hit a peak circulation of 2.8 million in 1973 and has been in decline ever since, leaving the younger people of today unable to recognize the gap-toothed grin of Mad Magazine mascot Alfred E. Newman, which is why 37-year-old Pete Buttigieg didn't understand when Trump likened the presidential hopeful to the magazine's trademark cartoon cover boy.
Donald Trump today, in an interview, compared you to the Mad Magazine mascot, said Alfred E. Newman can never be president. What's your response to
that? So I'll be honest, I had to Google that. I guess it's a generational thing. I didn't get the reference.
In a recent piece for The Nation, national affairs correspondent Jeet Heer said that Mad Magazine defined an entire generation's distrust of the media, politicians, advertisers, and all sorts of authority. And even the authorities, at least of a certain age, recognized that.
I thought that was very revealing because on the one hand, you have Trump, who's loathsome, but has a sort of populist touch, and he had the exact right reference because Buttigieg does look a little bit like Alfred E. Newman. And then you have Buttigieg touting his knowledge of James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake and not familiar with Mad Magazine, although in some ways I would argue Mad was the Finnegan's Wake of American childhood. Imagine not even being completely facetious, because Mad had a kind of density to it. If you were a kid, there were a lot of references that you would not necessarily get.
Oh my God, the Mad Magazine Special Edition. They only put out 17 of these a year. Boy, they're really socking it to that Spiro Agnew guy again. He must work there or something.
But even beyond that, linguistically, Harvey Kurtzman, the first editor, came out of a Jewish immigrant background, and he threw in a lot of Yiddish words and phrases, which became a familiar part of the Mad dialect. So it is defensible to call Mad the Finnegan's Wake of American childhood.
So how did the self-styled usual gang of idiots behind the magazine get you hooked?
Like a lot of kids, what partially attracted me was the sort of parody of the sort of popular culture around me. The first Star Wars was taking off, and they would have their own version of it. Was it Louse Skywalker? There was a kind of visceral pleasure of seeing stuff that you're familiar with from movies and TV in this kind of funhouse version. And I think the adultness of it, it really came out of this ethos of talking to kids as if they could handle the truth. There's a psychiatrist named Frederick Wertham who wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent about how comic books were destroying youth and turning them into juvenile delinquents. Mm-hmm. Parent-teacher groups and church groups organized comic book burnings. This happened on a mass scale in America. William Gaines, the publisher of Mad, was a major target because he published these horror comics.
And he was dragged before a Senate committee.
WNYC is about to bring you the afternoon session of the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency, investigating the effect of comic books on the increased rate of juvenile crime.
I was the first publisher in these United States to publish horror comics. I'm responsible. I started them. Some may not like them. That's a matter of personal taste.
Gaines' argument before the Senate was that, you know, kids can differentiate between fantasy and reality, and they can tell if a work of art is too much for them or if it suits them.
What are we afraid of? Are we afraid of our own children? Do we forget that they are citizens too and entitled to the essential freedom to read? Or do we think our children so evil, so vicious, so simple-minded that it takes but a comic magazine story of murder to set them to murder, of robbery to set them to robbery.
That was not a popular idea in the early 1950s.
You wrote in your piece that Gaines didn't really acquit himself all that well in his Senate testimony, that it almost sounded like a Mad Magazine parody.
Gaines was on diet pills, which kept him up all night. And so when he was in front of the committee, he was sweating and distracted. And other comic book publishers and artists were watching. They were like, oh, my God, this man has killed our industry. And he did. They created this sort of self-censorship institute within comics, the Comics Code Authority, which was basically designed to put Bill Gaines out of business. So that was one of the impetuses for Gaines deciding to take Mad from a comic book into a magazine where he wouldn't be censored as much.
In your piece, you began by discussing Mad's depiction of the Army-McCarthy hearings. You say that satire wasn't directed just at McCarthy's dishonesty, but also, more pointedly, at the media that allowed the rabble-rouser to rule the national stage. That sounds kind of familiar.
The whole parody was basically turning the McCarthy hearings into a game show.
And now let's all play What's My Line?
There's a show called What's My Line? And in the Mad version, it became What's My Shine? Which is a very pointed joke because David Shine was the lover of Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's henchman. The point was that McCarthy had turned politics into entertainment. And in the parody, Roy Cohn is sort of seen hovering over Joseph McCarthy like a ventriloquist with his dummy. The artists and editors behind Mad, especially Harvey Kurtzman, came out of this real immigrant background and raised by things like the Marx Brothers, this anarchic humor of the 20s and 30s, which had fallen out of fashion in the 1950s when it was really all Leave It to Beaver. I think in the pages of Mad, they kept this sort of anarchic immigrant humor alive and really planted the seeds for much of the culture that would come later.
So let's talk about those seeds of distrust in America's youth. How did it influence their attitudes as adults, do you think?
It taught that it was okay to make fun of authority and that people in authority could be lying to you. The cartoonist Art Spiegelman, who grew up on Mad, said that the message was you shouldn't trust people in power, you shouldn't trust the media, and by the way, we're the media as well. So it had this sort of self-reflexive aspect to it. I think that funhouse aspect, this alternative reality, was very powerful. The singer Patti Smith said, after Mad, drugs were nothing. I kind of think that she meant Mad was kind of like the red pill, that once you like read it, you saw that the reality that you were being sold was not the real reality, and the impact was not unlike hallucinogenic drugs.
And part of Mad's power to do that derived from its very long no advertising policy. I mean, from 1957 to 2001.
They were losing advertisers, and the publisher, Bill Gaines, said, let's turn this problem into a virtue. And Gaines cited this earlier newspaper, PM, which never took advertising, and that allowed it to be a muckraking thing. And the big thing was, if you remember the magazines from the 60s and 70s, they were always full of like cigarette ads and alcohol ads, and Mad had the freedom to like actually go after cigarette companies.
You mentioned that the offspring of Mad can be found in Saturday Night Live and The Onion, The Simpsons, National Lampoon, Stephen Colbert. I mean, all of these.
Mad came in the 50s when there's starting to be a television in every home. It realized that the media itself was a ripe target. That became a kind of recurring feature of American satire. The Onion is a great example because it's like a fake newspaper and it's making fun of all the conventions of the media.
I just wonder, is it really the progenitor of all of these, or is it just the one that those of us who are older than Pete Buttigieg can actually remember? I mean, I don't remember William Gaines's influence, the tabloid PM. I wasn't alive in the 40s. I do remember Mad. I sure do. But do we have to go back to Aristophanes?
In the 50s, Mad was really important because it was almost the only thing that was available. Gloria Steinem made the point when she said that there's a spirit of satire and irreverence in Mad that was very important, and it was the only place you could find it in the 50s. It had anarchic humor in an age of conformity.
Why did Mad start accepting ads?
This was after Bill Gaines died. He died in 1992, and it was about a decade after. The argument that they made was, well, advertising isn't as important a feature of culture, and it's a very fragmented thing. So if you make fun of an ad, a lot of people might not be familiar with the original ad you're making fun of.
I don't know if I buy that, do you?
Well, I don't think so either. I mean, but I think it's fair to say that in his later period, Mad lost some of that original take-no-prisoner spirit, and maybe taking advertising was one of the mistakes they made. But also, it was in some ways a victim of its own success, that it had created a whole style of humor that was then picked up by so many other people that it wasn't distinguished in the way that it was in the 50s.
Mad lived through the invention of video games, the internet, meme culture. Did the digital landscape just basically swallow it up and burp?
I think that one of the things about Mad was this density of it. The artists were really encouraged to go wild. So, you know, the writer would do the main story and the dialogue, but every page was packed with detail. And it was a type of reading that maybe has fallen out of fashion.
You mean it was too hard to read Mad?
I occasionally teach, and I see this among university students even. They like stuff that's more straightforward, that isn't Baroque. Even what they read in literary terms, spending an hour on a page is not what people do anymore.
As a boomer, someone who grew up into the hippie era, there was a sense that Mad gave us that we knew better. Do you think it contributed to that? That the anti-war movements and so on were sparked by a sense of separation from the dominant culture?
There's several levels of that, where there's one is a sort of a teaching a kind of distrust of authority, but then also teaching that humor can be a potent response to deflating authority. People like Abby Hoff, there's no way that the yippies with their, you know, idea of running Pigasus for president weren't inspired by Mad Magazine.
Let me end where I began, with Alfred E. Newman, the gap-toothed, wide-smiling mascot of the magazine. He had a famous slogan. What? Me worry? What did that mean?
It has layers of meaning. You only say, what, me worry, when you are scared. So it's a way of acknowledging fear, but also distancing yourself from it. And I think that's what the sort of idiotic grin of Alfred E. Newman is all about.
Is there a particular parody in Mad Magazine that you remember really well?
Actually, the one was Hogan's Heroes, which was a show I enjoyed when I was a kid.
A sitcom based in a German prisoner of war camp.
That's right, that's right. And the Mad parody, it was like very brutal because they, you know, made fun of the show, and then the last page was like, well, let's take Hogan's Heroes to its logical conclusion and have a sitcom set in the concentration camp. So they had all the characters looking very realistically as if they were in a death camp. And that was like such a real punch in the face, because it really brutally brought out, you know, what was wrong about the concept of Hogan's Heroes. There are a lot of people now saying, well, it's woke millennials who can't understand, you know, Hogan's Heroes. But actually, the critique of Hogan's Heroes was already there in Mad Magazine in the 60s.
And not just a critique of the show, but of the uncomprehending nature of an entertainment media that would produce it.
That's right. Yeah, it was a very angry parody. You can't just take stuff like Hogan's Heroes for granted. What are the underlying messages? Sometimes those aren't good messages.
Jeet, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Jeet here is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation.
It's a gas!
That's it for this week's Pod Extra. For some anarchic humor of the OTM variety, sign up for the newsletter at omnimedia.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.